Guys, I think most of you know that Gracie Mann has a steadfast position in opposition to abortion. We consider it a great blight to be murder. And there's several ways that we try to oppose it. And one of the things that happens each year is this a campaign put on by a national organization called 40 Days for Life, where you stand peacefully and prayerfully in front of Planned Parenthood, which is down on Poplar. That 40-day period begins this Saturday, at least for us. We'll be involved on Saturdays and Mondays for 4 weeks, I think. So if you are interested in standing, you carry a little sign about abortion, but you're not trying to, you know, engage anybody unless they engage you first. It's just a peaceful demonstration against abortion. So if you're interested, you can call Peggy Daugherty, or I bet you Trent Fleming would talk to you too. I got several things to do tonight, and I some of them kind of rosy, but one of them isn't, and I'm not sure. I don't know that I should do this, but how many of you were aware that I think it was back in October, a man on a Saturday morning entered our gym and ripped the television off the wall and walked out with it? And, you know, we have cameras. Did you see the footage of that? You know, okay, you saw that footage. Good. Well, we because of our security cameras, that man was caught and he went to prison. I visited him while there in prison at 201 Poplar, and spent an hour with him, and he talked for 30 minutes, and I talked for 30 minutes, and presented the gospel to him. And he has made a profession of faith and has written me a couple of times. I got this letter today. I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but I wanted to read you snatches out of it because, guys, I always try to adopt a wait-and-see posture, you know, to see if what is said is real. But there are some words that, I mean, one of the athletes after the Super Bowl this weekend was interviewed, and he talked about the man upstairs. Well, if you talk about the man upstairs to me, I immediately conclude you don't have the slightest idea what you're talking about. To call God the man upstairs is just intolerable. But when people start talking about the Lord and Christ and my Savior, you know, I started listening pretty closely. Can I read you some of this? I'm not going to read you the whole thing. I want to thank you personally and discuss some things that have been on my mind as a new Christian. I'm so eager for fellowship with other believers, and I can't wait to find a church home. I have a very different plan for the steps I need will take once I'm out of jail. I am really looking forward to that. As far as my walk with Christ goes, it has been more wonderful than I could have ever imagined. I have come to realize that I have been sinful and God has redeemed me. I have lived outside of God's grace and I have paid for it. My disobedience has been shocking even to a guy like me, and I refuse to live that way again. I love reading the Bible and praying and spending time with God. The godly disciplines I have started in jail, I plan to continue in my walk outside of jail. Also, the Bible is so great, but it is sometimes hard for me to get the real meaning by myself, but I do the best I can, reading the Bible and praying 4 to 5 hours a day, and I'm afraid I'm missing out on some of the things that are said there because I do not understand them. I have a long way to go, but thanks for the new start. That, to me, sounds like a man who has come to know Jesus Christ. And if, you know, we certainly won't be knee-jerking, but he in the letter, he's supposed to get out in the next few days and wants to come to church here. And oh, that Gracie Mann would be a place where a man who has found Christ in prison could come and be comfortable. And if it turns out that indeed it does appear real, I'm going to introduce him to you. As the man who stole our television, and I still have not yet forgiven him for doing so. No. In fact, we talked about the television when I went to see him, and I said, listen, we don't care about that television. But anyway, that is such a... I got that today, and I wrote... I've already written him back, and...
When does he get out?
He said in the next few days, but I'm sure that in the letter... You don't know in the prison system, you know, what that means. I'm hoping... I'm not going to do anything right away, but I, you know, just after a while, if indeed it appears that God has really done a work, I'm going to let him stand up in front of you and tell you the story after we show you the film clip. anyways, it's kind of exciting. All right, and one of the controversial things is I hope you know that you are just not with it. You're just not with it. I don't see anybody with ashes on their foreheads, and today is Ash Wednesday. If you're a part of a church like this one, whose tradition is not to observe Lent, there's really nothing wrong with Lent. There's nothing that certainly Christians need to meditate more and on the cross of Christ and spend some time in repentance. There's nothing. My objection to Lent or to Ash Wednesday is that the Roman Catholic Church insists that they be the ones to mark you with the ashes in a mass in a worship service that is called mass. So there's no wannabes out there. You can't mark yourself if you want to have a little something on your head. You have to go to mass and get it, and which I think is outrageous. But I did want you to know that today begins the beginning of Lent. So if you want to observe that, there's certainly nothing inappropriate about saying, I recognize my sin and want to be more eager in repentance and concentrating on the death of Christ for my sin. You know, who could object to that? So you missed out because none of you have any ashes. And by the way, the ashes are supposed to come from palm branches or palm leaves that you burned last year, and those ashes left over, and you're supposed to use those. We didn't have any left over, so... guys, what I'm about to do, I may regret. Is my wife here? My wife is sick, and she called me about a quarter to six and said that she was headed to get a prescription filled. And if she got the prescription, she'd be here. But if she didn't get it, she was going to wait because she is so eager to get something in her that will fix her. But that she's not here... allows me to do things with that I wouldn't and shouldn't have done in the first place. And so, don't anybody tell her. Here we are again, another Wednesday night, and we've dedicated this time to Bible study. Bible study. I hope you understand what Bible study is. It really is nothing more than one long, lifelong, extended counseling session. Guys, what we're offering you here in this Bible study is cognitive therapy. Because what we're trying to do is to bring our thinking into line with the truths that are found in here. In essence, we're trying to learn how to think correctly. That's what cognitive therapy is, adjusting the way that you think. And that's what a Bible study is about. It's adjusting or it's seeking to adjust the way that you think. Now, we're going to get to Galatians 4 in just a minute. But guys, you and I are bombarded by messages encouraging us to think wrongly. The media is simply... seeking to get out their message. And you cannot blame them for that. But that's what the church is trying to do. We're trying to get out a message too. We just don't do it as well as they do it. I mean, they reach 114 million viewers in one football game. We reach 300 people every Wednesday night, you know. Both trying to do the same thing, get out a message so that people will think differently. You do know, do you not? I hope you know that as a man thinketh, so is he. We live out our belief systems. You are living out your belief system even this very minute. So Bible study is the purpose, or one of the purposes, is that we will learn to think God's thoughts after him and live out that life that is in tune with his word. I would say to you, because of the bombardment of the culture, that Bible study is even more urgent than perhaps ever before. The louder the world shouts, the louder I have to shout. That's a scary thought, isn't it? Somebody I read one time said, I shout not to convince them, but to keep them from convincing me. And I want to give you an example tonight of a piece of thinking that I'm going to try to affect. By the way, we're going to come to Galatians 4, we'll get to that in a minute. But this is there's a sense in which I think I owe you this, because you just keep getting bombarded with these messages, and I think, wait a minute now. You didn't buy into that, did you? But this you may not even agree with me about, but I want to say it again. I have been saying for years that you should not put your hope in the political process, in political parties, in government. I have said to you that Jesus was far more liberal than any Democrat, and he was far more conservative than any Republican. And again, I don't know what your political leanings are, and I'm not trying to influence those, but I am saying this. I think you can see that in the present political process how chaotic things are, whether you think they're going to shake down in your way or not. I don't know. I'm not here to affect that. But I think there is certainly a good deal of political chaos. And I probably, along with you, have been watching the political process unfold. And one thing came up recently in this primary in New Hampshire that I wanted to address, because I wonder if you think like this, and I'm going to try to address that. And it had to do with heroin addiction. Did you see what, you know, that was one of the big issues in New Hampshire, that they lose over 400 people a year, over one a day, to heroin addiction in New Hampshire. And so all of these town meetings that were being held with the candidates, the electorate kept asking the candidate. And if I heard it one time, I heard it a dozen at least. What are you going to do about this dreaded disease of heroin addiction? Now, into that quagmire, I would like to wade. And I would like to suggest another way of thinking. Okay? I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm not trying to, if you disagree with me, that is fine, but I hope you'll at least hear me out. Ladies and gentlemen, you have to understand that the culture will tell you that addictions are diseases. They are not diseases. Addiction is not a disease. It is sin. And if you persist in calling addictions a disease, then I want to say to you that you remove all hope. Because there is no known medical cure for these addictions. Tell me, how many times do you sit across your desk from someone dealing with an addiction? I do it 4 or 5 times a year. And if I look across my desk and I say to you, I'm sorry you've got this dreaded disease of a heroin addiction or an alcohol addiction, then I have destroyed hope. Because nobody's got a medical pill for him to swallow and get beyond that. Now, guys, let me be abundantly clear. I am not saying that there are not physical components to, let's say, alcoholism. And that at some point, your body doesn't become an enemy, and your body begins to demand that drug. That in the process, it no longer becomes, I want it, but I have to have it. I'm not denying that fact. I get that. I'm not even saying that there may not be factors in your genetic disposition or in your personality or whatever that would make you more predisposed to some kind of addiction. I get that too. But here's what I am saying. When at the very beginning when I choose to find my solutions or my escape on the wings of a feel-good drug, that is sin. The thing is born in sin. I heard Steve Brown say one time, if you want to choose sin, Satan will grease your skids. He'll help you get there. And what I'm saying is, along that process, surely the body will become an enemy and will begin to demand. I get that, but I'm saying at its inception, when I'm choosing to say, I've got problems, I want to escape, I want to be happy, and you choose to get those things by the use of some kind of stimulant, that is not a disease. If you call it a disease, the first thing that you do is that you rid that person of any kind of responsibility. I am where I am because I have a disease. You don't upbraid someone with cancer. But if you make alcoholism a disease, then you remove all responsibility and you rob them of any hope. I am not opposed. I'm not opposed to drugs. There are so many wonderful drugs out there that are available and needed by so many of us. They could be taken like insulin or statins, you know. Some of them can be taken temporarily. Some of them are needed for a lifetime. And I would even go so far as to say that in the beginning of dealing with an addiction, there may need to be some help with drugs. I get that. All I'm saying is that once this thing begins, it begins with a sinful choice. And then, and I do believe in a personal devil that gets involved and then just takes you down a path. He greases the skids. Gang, the solution is not going to be found in a pill, because we don't even have one that I can give to a heroin addict. So if you tell him that he's got a disease and then say, but, you know, I don't have anything to give you. How kind is that? I do have a solution. And when I sit across my desk from an addict, I can give them hope. And I tell them that Jesus Christ is their solution. Now, guys, I know you think, well, you know, you got to say that. You're paid to say that. You're a preacher, and you know that's all you do is say that kind of stuff. You know, well, you just say Jesus, you know, Jesus, Jesus. You. Okay, I understand that you may think that, but I'm asking you this: what solution do you have? Or New Hampshire? What solution? Because it ain't working. And I think, guys, It's because of that piece of wrong thinking. If your thinking is such that an addiction is a disease, then you know, gang, the essence of sin is to think that I can live life without God. And so to solve my many problems, I've got to turn this way instead of turning to Him. And I'm telling you, that's tragedy. That message that was the reply of those candidates to those questions in New Hampshire, I thought, somebody stop. Somebody stop. Somebody say, well, there's one solution, but you're not going to like it. And, you know, the people who sit across from me, they don't usually like my solution. He did. And by the way, he will tell you that the reason that he stole was to support his drug habit. But the solution is, I mean, gang, it's two ways of thinking. Addictions. It's a disease. It's a sin. If you think like this, you're going to go in this direction. But if you think like this, you're going to go in another direction. And I'm saying, this is cognitive therapy. I'm just trying to affect your thinking. I'm just trying to, and if you don't agree, that's fine. But when they come to you, send them to me. Or send them to somebody else who will tell them or point them to Jesus. Because ultimately, gang, you are wounding people. They don't think they're, you know, but you're wounding people by saying, oh, poor, poor, pitiful you. You've got a disease. And guess what? We have absolutely no cure for you. That's not kind. That's not loving. What I think is loving is to say there is a cure. There is hope. And let me tell you about him. That, I think, guys, is just... that came up from this whole New Hampshire thing, and I wanted to say it and continue on with our study of Galatians. So... let's get to the text, guys. Verses 6 and 7 of Galatians 4. I want to point you at two things in the text, and we'll be done. And because you were sons, God has sent the Spirit of His Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. Now, here's the first thing that I want you to see, guys. Go look at the last three words of verse 5. From the last three words of verse 5 to the end of verse 7, there are 41 words. I counted them. 41 words. In those 41 words, you find this. You find adoption mentioned once. You find the term sons or son, singular plural, four times. You find the phrase, not a slave, once, and you find an heir, H-E-I-R, once, and that is not to mention the mention of Abba, Father. So in a span of 41 words, 14 of those 41 words are pounding you with one idea, one notion. 14 of 41 words, all saying the same thing. And what the Apostle Paul is doing is trying to impress upon you, or perhaps even ask you, are you as a Christian living like a slave who is afraid of God, tyrannized by a set of rules and law-keeping? Or are you like a child? Are you living out your Christian experience like a child who is assured of his father's love? How are you living out yours? Because, guys, this is a text. These two verses are saturated with sonship language. Oh, you're adopted as a son, 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 as a not an heir, as an Abba, Abba Father. 41 words, 14 of them are saying the same thing over and over. You know, people complain to me about saying, well, you know, you're always saying the same stuff. And I say, yeah, well, I sure am. 14 of the of 41 words, guys. Trying to, you know, I was thinking, this happened to me just earlier this evening, but I was meeting with a guy who owns a business, and he just hired his son. And, you know, he's not real sure it was a good move to hire his son, but, you know, he did it and, you know, prayed about it a lot and hired his son. You know, there's one advantage of a son working for a father. You don't get fired. Fathers don't fire their sons, you know? But I'm telling you, we live like we're going to be fired. We live like we're on this, we're teetering on the edge, and if our performance is really good, he'll keep us. But if my performance slips over, you know, it gets pretty bad, then I might get fired. Guys, sons don't get fired. All of this, this sonship, is not something that we earned. It's all by the grace of an adopting God. But guys, you see, I hope, in these two verses, that Paul's goal, that his desire is to see Christians living with a high degree of certainty about who they are. And in 41 words, he tells you 14 times. Well, he uses 14 words of the 41 words. I guess 5 times in the span of two verses, he's saying the same thing. He wants you to live with a high degree of assurance. You know, guys, that sense of certainty removes the fear that is the root of so much of our disobedience. Let me give you an example. When I'm not sure that he really does love me and thus does not have my best interest at heart, then I'm going to have to take over. And I'm not sure that my future is good. So I'm going to take over my future. And I'm going to start making decisions that I think would make my life better, because I'm not sure that this God really does love me. And then Satan gets involved and whispers in your ear, he's angry with you. He's mad at you. And that gives rise to all of these decisions, or many, many decisions, that lead to disobedience. Yes, guys, I understand. To be sure, there is much that opposes us in our quest for this kind of certainty. Yes. First of all, I got a sin nature, and there's still sin remaining in me. My faith is not real stellar. It's rather brittle. It's rickety. It's rather feeble. And I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that one of the remedies for a rickety faith is to more intake of God's truth. You need to be taken again and again and again. Oh, right here in Galatians 4. And then all of us carry around this inborn suspicion about God. We're not really sure. You know, guys, in Genesis chapter 3, when Satan met up with Eve, you know how he deals with her, don't you? You remember? He says, has God really said that you should not eat of that tree? You know what that real is in there? You know why that's in there, don't you? It's a sneer. It's kind of, I mean, is God going to be mean to you? I mean, you really need to think about whether he's good or not. Did he really say something that bad? And so you start thinking, So there's this suspicion that we've got inside of us. Is he really my father? And when I conclude otherwise, then I start making choices that get myself in trouble. And by the way, I should add this, and looks like we're only going to get one of these points, but in addition to all those things fighting me, then there's Rome and her influence on all of us. I would love to know how many of you have Roman Catholic backgrounds, but I'm not going to ask. Because I hope you know that Rome denies the possibility of any of the existence of assurance. She wants her people to live in a constant state of uncertainty. And somehow that's kind of wafted over to, to the evangelical world, And then on top of all of that denial of the possibility of having any assurance, she says the way that God is really going to treat you is that once life is over, you're going to go to this place where you're going to have to burn off some of that thing, those things that you never should have done anyway. And I don't know how long that's going to last. It might last for, a couple of thousand years in this purgatory place. Ha! He's really upset, but he's going to get you later. So I'm fighting my own sin. I'm fighting that my faith is brittle. I've got this inborn suspicion of God. And then Rome comes along and tells me that there's a purgatory awaiting me where I can really get rid of my sin. And Paul says to you, 8 times in 41 words, that we ought to be living like we're not afraid, but that we can't get fired. We can't get booted out of the kingdom. If I belong to him, he's never going to boot me out of the kingdom. Now, guys, that's not a license to sin. In fact, it's a license just for the opposite. It's a license for a life of gratitude. Oh, my goodness, he's loved me with everlasting love. There is a Hebrew word that you found it several times in the book of Ruth, but you find it over and over and over again in the book of Psalms. It's spelled that way. They told me to go slower, It's spelled hesed in English. It's the Hebrew letters. It's not important. But do you know what hesed is? Hesed is steadfast love. You find it in your English translations. Every time you find steadfast love, that's the Hebrew word that's there. It has to do with loyalty. But it is not your loyalty to him, it is his to you. And don't you remember when Ruth went out and Boaz gave her that big basket full of stuff, and she came home, and Naomi says to her, "You have found hesed. You found steadfast love. You found a love that was loyal." That's the love, ladies and gentlemen, that we're supposed to be living, believing that is ours. And that is why men like Martin Luther said, the doctrine of justification by faith alone, which is nothing more than the gospel, but that the doctrine of justification by faith alone ought to be preached in every sermon. Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, it's not just the doctrine that counts. It's the ramifications of that doctrine one of which is the realization that God has granted me a love that is loyal. Again, not mine to him. His to me. And because of this, because I'm a son, I can't get fired. And so that makes me serve him in a different way than serving him on that fine edge of wondering, have I done enough so that he'll be pleased with me today? Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's to live like a slave. And this text is saturated with 8 references to living life a different way, like a son. One of my buddies that I was just told has died. I mean, I hadn't seen Steve in years, but Steve Brown, you know, Key Life, somebody told me in Systematics that he died. He did not tell me that he had died. But he and I carry on a phone conversation, you know, every now and then, nothing frequently. But Steve Brown went in every sermon like this. After he had said all of this has said stuff, or this is, and all of this 14 words and 41 words and all of that, he would close every sermon by saying this. You think about that. That's cognitive therapy, ladies and gentlemen. Bible study is a lifelong counseling session. Go think about that. Let's quit. Our Father, I pray that you will impress upon your people the dominant theme of this section of your word, that we can breathe deeply, that we can relax, we can rest, not in our loyal love to you, but in your loyal love, your steadfast love to us. Might your people, in an ever-increasing way, begin to get that. Do that, Father, for Jesus' sake. We pray in his name.